Hello, and welcome back to Dagish America Presents. I'm Ben Harl, and as always, I'm so happy to have the opportunity to talk to you about the industry that I work in. On the last episode, we talked to Pete Miller about the application day. Now, if you haven't had a chance yet, please go back and give that episode a listen, because it has a lot of really good information. And today, we're going to talk about the exposure period. With the introduction of the fumigant being complete, there are still several things that need to be done to maintain the facility or commodity during that fumigant exposure period. And to help us explore some of these tasks, we've invited Bartek Dranowski, President and CEO of Dagish America, to join us. So, please help me welcome Bartek to the podcast. Bartek, how you doing today?
I'm doing very well, Ben. Thanks for having me again.
Oh, thanks for agreeing to join me again. I really appreciate it. I always like to start out. I know you've been a guest on the podcast before, but I always like to give everybody kind of an opportunity at the beginning of the conversation to kind of tell us a little bit about themselves. So if you could do that, that'd be great.
Sure, man. I'd love to. So my name is Bartek Dranowski, and I currently serve as the president and CEO of our North American operations, mainly Dagish America and Dagish Canada. I started my career as a technician preparing tobacco warehouses for fumigation while attending college about 30 years ago. While managing our East Coast operations years later, I became much more well-versed in vessel fumigations, mill fumigations, processing facility fumigations, etc., and diversified from just warehouse and tarp fumigations that were the main aspect of tobacco fumigation. It's exciting to work in Dagish as we not only provide service, but we're also a product registrant. We are the only producer of metal phosphides in North America, allowing us for all perspectives of the fumigant life cycles to coexist within our single entity. So it's great to see the product from manufacture all the way to actual use as an end user as well. So it gives us a really nice perspective.
Oh, it's great. It's one of the things I enjoy the most about the company, you know, being a Dagish employee, seeing it all the way from the inception and the creation of the product all the way to when it's used in the field. You know, it's pretty interesting to be involved with all aspects of that.
For sure.
Yeah. So this season, we've been kind of talking about the fumigation process, you know, everything from inspecting and bidding all the way through aeration and deactivation of spent fumigant when it's required. But today, I kind of wanted to talk about what transpires during the exposure period, because a lot of people think that once you've actually applied the fumigant to the structure, that you can just kind of go home and wait for a few days before you have to go back and start the aeration process at the end of it. But that's not the case. There's a lot of things that we have to do during that exposure period. And I know with your experience that you have a pretty good bead or line on some of those things that we have to do. So that's kind of what I wanted to talk about with you today. And one of the first things that I wanted to talk about was monitoring, because that's definitely one of the key things that you have to do during the exposure period is efficacy monitoring. So I just kind of wanted to have you walk us through some of the steps of efficacy monitoring. You know, I mean, how often do the readings need to be taken? Kind of where you want to place the monitoring lines, things like that.
Sure. Great question, Ben. And to pay tribute to my predecessor, Mr. Herb Yeaman, he coined the phrase, if you're not monitoring, you're not fumigating.
Yeah.
Because that truly is critical to know exactly what's going on inside the structure to make sure that you're providing the customer with what you're obligated to provide the customer with, which is our certain concentrations for certain exposure times to ensure lethal concentrations for all life stages to be eradicated inside that structure. So efficacy monitoring is your way of checking that. So I will also then just real quickly also address industrial hygiene monitoring, because that is critical as well. And it really sort of plays into efficacy monitoring in a certain way as well. But let's start with efficacy monitoring. So again, monitoring is critical to the success of the fumigation and the only way to prove that the desired concentration has been achieved. Making sure that the sampling lines or reading locations are representative and in a sufficient number. So what does that mean? Depending on the structure, if it's a multi-story structure, for example, it may be necessary to place sampling lines on each floor, especially if you're dealing with a fumigant that has a vapor pressure higher or lower than ambient air. There may be some fumigant shifts. If you're using recirculation fans or if you're using just fans in general to move the fumigant around, you want to make sure that you place your sampling lines in areas that may be the most difficult for the fumigant to reach, because that way you're ensuring that the furthest away, the nooks and crannies, the smaller rooms, basements, smaller pieces of equipment have actually been able to receive full penetration from the fumigant. So that's important. The length of the line is also important if you're using sampling lines. So make sure you double check with your equipment and see what the limitations are and how big of a diameter you can use for sampling and for good monitoring, because inside the sampling line, there is some friction loss. And to put in a 500-600 foot sampling line and expect a very weak pump to be able to draw an adequate sample may be exceeding the limitations of that equipment. So make sure you double check with your equipment. Make sure the sampling pumps you have are adequate for the length and diameter of sampling lines that you're using. As far as frequency, 1 day minimum. Then that's for multi-day fumigations or multi-week fumigations. If you have grain fumigations or some tobacco fumigations that are 10, 12, 14, 18 days, then at least on a daily basis, it's critical to make sure that the fumigant levels are where they need to be. For shorter fumigations with SF methyl bromide, for fumigations that are measured in hours, the monitoring should occur every few hours or per the treatment schedule. Obviously, the fumigant guide has requirements of how often readings should be taking. If you're following a PPQ manual, there may be some specific instructions on how often readings must be recorded as well to ensure that the proper exposure is achieved inside. So in conjunction with efficacy monitoring is also industrial hygiene monitoring. And industrial hygiene monitoring is mostly done for the safety of the employees, the bystanders, general public, et cetera, et cetera. But if you're picking up concentrations around the perimeter of the fumigation, that may also lead you to do some investigating as to where these fugitive emissions are coming from. So keeping track with those readings is critical to make sure that everything is happening inside and outside the way you want it. Obviously, if it's an outdoor type of fumigation, whether it's a warehouse processing facility, outdoor tarp or something like that, additional readings should be taken after any sort of significant event, weather events, storms, periods of high wind. Large temperature fluctuations may also affect it, as the interior space in the building is breathing and warm air is expanding and cold air is contracting. The significant temperature changes may influence the concentrations as well. And the most critical part of all monitoring is that the data must be recorded, whether it's on a sheet of paper, whether it's electronically, whether it's done via the monitoring equipment. All of the concentrations must be recorded. And at minimum, the fumigator should keep up with the concentration in PPM, the time at which the reading was taken, the location, and the person who performed the reading. So their name, their initials. So there's accountability. So if there's a question about what the concentration was at a certain period of time, you know exactly who to go to confirm that things like the right place and right sampling lines were used. More excitingly, in our industry, there have been some technological advancements in monitoring with the development of remote monitoring sensors. So there are monitoring sensors that still use sampling lines on the exterior, and they can then upload readings into a cloud for SF as well for phosphine. We also have a new device called the Digatec remote monitoring system, which uses cellular data from inside the fumigated structure to transmit PPM concentrations in 15-minute increments. This patent-pending technology is a product that required years of research and trials. And right now we've had very successful use of the technology with our service offering. So that's definitely going to be the wave of the future, where it's not necessarily the fumigator with the tube and pump at the fumigation structure looking at the readings and drawing samples, but it is still a very effective way of doing it, and it certainly is better than no monitoring at all. So the nice thing about the remote monitoring process is that it removes a lot of the human error aspect from monitoring. So it allows for full process transparency for the fumigator and the customer to track what's going on, sometimes in real time, if the customer is also able to access the monitoring data so they can see what's going on within their fumigated structure. So I hope that's a good start. And this is what you're looking for, Ben, in your initial question.
No, absolutely. Yeah, that's a bunch of really, really good information. A couple things that I wanted to mention based on what you just shared, which was terrific. I know you mentioned that the length of the monitoring line and the diameter play a huge part in making sure that you have pumps that are powerful enough to draw a sample fast enough to get kind of a clean, what we call a clean reading. A lot of times the monitoring lines, you know, as you draw a sample through, the monitoring line will be full of the previous concentration. So you have to pull enough of the sample through the monitoring line to get a fresh reading from inside the structure, especially if it's a really long line. So I know what a lot of people do is they'll actually use what's called purge pumps, which are external pumps that aren't used in conjunction with a reading, but they're used to, they're stronger pumps, and they'll pull a sample through longer lines much faster. So what a lot of people do is they'll use these purge pumps to actually draw a sample through, because you can get a fresh sample in seconds rather than minutes with a stronger pump. Then after they actually get the fresh sample, then they'll connect to the monitoring device to get that reading from the fresh sample, because those pumps are stronger than the internal pumps in the actual monitoring devices. So that's a pretty popular thing to do. And then the other thing that I think that was really interesting too was how industrial hygiene monitoring kind of goes in conjunction with efficacy monitoring. And you're absolutely right, because it's not just used for bystander safety, but industrial hygiene monitoring also helps you determine or locate areas where you may have some leaking occurring that you can seal. And a lot of times when we're out on these job sites, especially in inclement weather, whatever the case is, you will have seals that'll crack open or seals that'll blow open. And industrial hygiene monitoring will help you pinpoint those, because they're not always really easy to find. Sometimes they are. You'll have plastic that's fallen off of a overhead door, and that's really easy to spot. But sometimes you'll have little cracks that'll appear in poly where the tape will just peel off a little bit. And you want to try to keep as much of that gas as you can. So that kind of segues really good into the next question I was going to ask you is, you know, if you're doing industrial hygiene monitoring and you do notice that you have a higher concentration in a certain exterior area of a structure, and you notice that there's a seal blown up, and what's your next steps?
Great question, Ben. And this is really where fumigation monitoring becomes critical, and the experience of the fumigator becomes critical as to how to maintain the concentration inside of this fumigated volume. Before I address that, if you don't mind, let me back up real quick to your purge pump suggestion, which is great, and it's a very widely used practice. What I often do is you can check the volume of the pump as to how many CFMs per minute it draws. And depending on what sort of sampling line you use, it's a fairly simple calculation to measure the volume of the inside diameter of the sampling line, and then see how long the purge pump will actually take to clear the air out of the entire line. So, for example, if the pump is one CFM per minute, and you're 200 feet of sampling line from the seventh floor of a fumigated structure are three CFMs interior volume of the tubing, then obviously logic would dictate that you need a minimum of 3 minutes of the purge pump activity to clear the line and get your new sample in. So those are calculations that can be done. And also, if you're doing just regular sampling with a pump-assisted monitoring device, see what the CFMs of that equipment are as well. So in addition to the limits of how long of a line it can pull from, see how long it takes until you start measuring the sample that's truly representative of what's going on inside the fumigated structure now versus the residual that may still be left in the sampling line. Does that make sense, Ben? Or how about to confuse the audience?
No, it makes perfect sense. I mean, and all of those pumps, you know, for the equipment that has internal pumps built in to help you pull for a reading, and also purge pumps, they all have tech specs. So you're absolutely right. They should have their CFM readings or how much they'll draw. And so you're 100% correct on that. You can actually calculate that, and it's going to tell you the minimum amount of time that you need to draw a sample. I think that's probably one of the biggest mistakes that I've seen fumigators make, is they don't allow the proper amount of time to pass when they're taking a monitoring reading. If you have 500 foot of line running up to a seventh floor, you're right, it could take 2 or 3 minutes before you get a fresh sample. Easily take 2 or 3 minutes. And I've seen a lot of fumigators out there, they'll take a sample, they'll draw for 30 seconds, and then they'll write that reading down. Well, that may not be the correct reading. You know, if it's 20 foot, 30 foot of line, it may be, but if it's 200 to 500 feet of line, you need to know how long it's going to take before you get that fresh sample. So if people are making an inaccurate reading, that's usually the reason why, in my opinion.
Exactly right, Ben. You're right. So, all right, let's bounce back to your blown seal question. So Boy, this is tricky. And this is where again, the judgment of the fumigator is so critical, because obviously a damaged or lost seal needs to be addressed. And sometimes not doing anything about it at all is a way of addressing it. So many considerations. Let's start with safety first and foremost. Is it safe to even get into that area? How can you reach the blown seal? If it's an exterior seal that's three or four stories up, do you have a way of reaching it that's safe? Do you have the proper respiratory equipment to ensure that the fumigator or the whoever's assisting with repairing the seal isn't exposed to excessive levels of fumigant? Is the weather right to do so? Again, all these considerations should run through your mind. If you do have a blown seal and you do have fairly high concentrations and you're only an hour or two away from concluding the fumigation, is it even necessary to try to repair that seal? Some are no-brainers. You have a ground level seal, you're days into a fumigation and some tape had busted loose on an entry door or something like that. That's a no-brainer. But obviously anything that requires ladders, aerial equipment, and the worst or the most challenging of all would be if it requires interior entry. So it's the risk of placing an employee inside of a fumigated space. Is that worth fixing the broken seal? And can it be done sufficiently? Or is the seal just going to bust again an hour later? So many considerations, and a lot of different variables have to be taken into play. The timing of the fumigation. How close are you to wrapping up the fumigation? Or if you're in the very beginning stages of it, and it's a significant seal that has come loose, it's critical to fix it the best you can, obviously. If you're nearing the very end of the fumigation, then perhaps just close monitoring, acknowledging that you do have some fumigant emissions coming out of there, monitoring those fugitive emissions to make sure that you're not exposing anyone into unnecessary high levels of fumigant.
You're absolutely right. And I'm really glad that you mentioned the fact that, you know, if you're 2-3 hours away from the end of the fumigation and you have a blown seal and you still have high concentrations, it may not be in your best interest to seal that back up, especially, you know, if labor considerations have to be taken. I mean, there's all kinds of different factors that have to be considered. So you're absolutely right on all of that.
Yeah, and you're right. The bottom line is safety. Safety of team members on the fumigation site, safety of any bystanders, safety of the general public, just to make sure that the seal repairs and the seal damage don't cross the line where you create an unsafe environment.
Absolutely. And, you know, blown seals, I hate to say that they're common, but I mean, they're kind of common. You know, we fumigate in inclement weather sometimes. We fumigate in situations where, you know, if it rains, sometimes that can pull seals down. High winds can pull seals down. So, I mean, there's all kinds of different things. So it's very commonplace to have seals, maybe not blow open, you know, not have the whole poly fall off of an overhead door. I mean, that does happen, but having a leaking building is pretty commonplace when you're working with these fumigants. A lot of them have high vapor pressures. They're always looking for a way out of the enclosed space. And there's no such thing as 100% sealed structure or fumigated area. The gas is always going to find a way to leak out. So you will have leakage over the course of the exposure period, but it's just making sure that you have control of it. You have the expectation of it. And if it gets out of hand, you have a safe way to recover it.
That's right. And many of my interactions with customers over the years, they would ask if we're going to make sure that the enclosure is airtight. And I will quickly point out that I've yet to find an airtight structure, including test chambers.
Yeah.
What we will do is we will make it airtight enough, but we will be able to maintain the prescribed concentration inside of those fumigated volume while ensuring that exterior of that volume is at a safe level for employees, bystanders, and anybody else who may be in that area. So, and Ben, the other part of blown seals is the prevention or the repair of blown seals sometimes starts before the fumigation. So the quality of the sealing is critical to make sure that you limit the opportunity for blown seals. And one of the limitations that we most of the time have is that we are using temporary seals to seal a structure. We're not using very strong adhesives that can't, because at the end of the day, at the end of the fumigation, at the end of the process, all of the temporary seals need to be removed. The facilities don't want leftover residues of plastic and mastic tapes and things that can be used to provide a much more permanent seal. So making sure that the sealing team uses good quality materials, that the surface that they are applying adhesive tapes and things like that to is as clean as possible to ensure that the tape will stick well to prevent blown seals later on. And it's amazing if it's done correctly, what sort of extreme weather conditions even these temporary seals can actually withstand. It's really kind of impressive.
No, and you're right. And I'm glad you mentioned weather as well, because that's another thing that you can kind of take into account when you're preparing for the fumigation. You know, you can look at the weather forecast. And if you're having to fumigate on a weekend where you do expect storms to come in, you know that you may have to take some extra steps to make sure that your seals don't blow open. Maybe use a little bit of a stronger adhesive if that's one option. There's all kinds of different things that you can do. If you expect the weather to change, if you expect rain and moisture can obviously have an effect on the adhesive properties of tape. So you may have to actually use more tape if you're expecting rain, or high winds, whatever the case is. So all of that kind of plays a part in that inspection and the site preparation.
That's exactly right. You know, you may have heard me say before that I always start a fumigation from the end as far as fumigant, because getting the fumigant in is easy. Getting the fumigant out is the toughest part, because oftentimes putting the fumigant in, you bring it on site in flasks or cylinders or whatever it may be, but it's in a way where you can control it and contain it. But once the fumigant has entered the structure in its gaseous state, keeping up with it is very difficult. Same thing with seals. So whenever we apply seals, once again, you want to ensure that they will withstand whatever Mother Nature will bring on during the exposure period. But at the same time, you want to ensure that the seals can be removed in a reasonable manner to leave the facility as clean as possible for the customer afterwards.
Yeah, and to be honest with you, when you're talking about inclement weather, you know, if the customer has some flexibility, you can even go to them. This has nothing to do with the exposure period, but I'll mention it anyway because it pertains to this particular portion of our conversation. I mean, if the customer has flexibility and you're expecting inclement weather, you can go to them and say, hey, look, you know, I hate to say it, but we have some really nasty storms coming in this weekend. I don't know if we can seal the structure safely or if we can seal the structure without leaving residues behind, or it's going to be really complicated. Is there any way that we can postpone this fumigation to a weekend or a time period where we're not expecting inclement weather? That's rarely the case. Usually the customer is very adamant about wanting a fumigation when they want it, but if they have flexibility, use it. I mean, don't force yourself to have to fumigate during time periods where there's a chance that you may not have good success.
And we've had these very conversations with customers, especially larger facility fumigations. For us operating on the East Coast and in the Gulf region, one of the most significant weather events, luckily, is often forecast days out. So if we know there's a pending hurricane or a tropical storm that's going to hit within the next 2 to 3, 4 days, that is not the time to start a fumigation.
yeah, absolutely. So, you know, when you have blown seals, obviously, you're going to be leaking gas. And sometimes, you know, again, these structures, some of them aren't very sound. So it's pretty commonplace for you to leak gas throughout the exposure period. As a matter of fact, that's the expectation. But what happens if your concentration falls below your target dosage? I mean, what do you do there? How do you recover that fumigation?
So hopefully you can recover. Oftentimes, if you are negligent or careless in your monitoring and the fumigation slips through your fingers because you didn't notice blown seals or weren't properly tracking your monitoring data, you may not be able to recover from the fumigation, depending on what the parameters are. If it's a quarantine or pre-shipment required fumigation, there are certain thresholds that you cannot go below. There are also recommendations. For example, going back to the tobacco example with the CORESTA standard, if the fumigation falls below 200, 300, 600, whatever the prescribed concentration of parts per million is, you're restarting the clock from time zero. So that's why monitoring is so critical to make sure that you do not fall below it. Yes, there are also customer conversations you can have that even though we did dip below what we had pledged, we're going to hold it for a little bit longer. So there is some flexibility perhaps. So there are ways of adding additional fumigant if the weather is right, if the timing is right. You can add more gas from a cylinder. You can add more gas internally if it's aluminum or magnesium phosphide type of fumigation. But it becomes a really, really awkward scenario at that point if you fall below the target concentration.
Yeah, and I'm glad that you mentioned, the monitoring part of that, because again, that's another reason why it's so critical that you monitor frequently enough, because you can catch these fumigations before they fall below the target dosage, and you can actually add fumigant before you dip below that target in order to make sure that you're maintaining that fumigation properly.
That's right. And that's where the fumigator's experience comes into play, because there is no formula that says, let's use a phosphine multi-day fumigation as an example. And if you're supposed to maintain 300 ppm, there is no formula that says every time you get below 350, you have to add additional fumigant, because that may not be enough, depending on the structure, depending on the forecast weather, depending on how high the wind is that afternoon, depending on the type of fumigant you're using, depending on the temperature and humidity. There are times when you can add additional magnesium phosphide, for example, to a fumigation, but the air is cool and dry to a point where the hydrolysis process doesn't occur fast enough to get you caught back up to the fumigation. So those are all considerations that have to be considered by the fumigator in charge. You know, you've heard me refer before to the sort of like the fire triangle, but what was the fumigation triangle of time, temperature, and exposure. Those are the three critical factors that have to be considered for a successful fumigation. And you can elongate, if you will, one side of that triangle to a certain point, but eventually you reach a limit where you can't add enough time to the fumigation to still make it a success, because what's probably the most difficult to control is the temperature. So you're sort of at the mercy of Mother Nature for temperature, and the concentrations are limited as well. So that's once again where it's critical to lean on the expertise and the intuitions of the fumigator to look at all of the different variables that must be considered to see how you can successfully recover from a fumigation that dipped below the desired concentration.
Yeah, and I'm really glad that you mentioned, when you use aluminum and magnesium phosphide, that you have to allow that chemical reaction to take place, because you're absolutely right. If you have 4 hours left, let's say if you have 4 hours left on fumigation and you're getting really close to falling below your target dosage, but you're using, say, aluminum phosphide for your fumigant, I mean, the amount of time it's going to take in a lot of situations for that chemical reaction to take place is going to go past that exposure period, or the end of the exposure period. And so that poses a couple of things. Number one, you may not achieve hydrolysis in enough time before you hit the end of your exposure period. And then also, if you don't, now you have partially spent fumigant that you have to deal with at the end of your exposure period, which we all can do. We know how to do the deactivation processes, but now you're adding another layer of complexity to the aeration and to the end of the fumigation, because now you have green dust, you have partially spent fumigant. You have to do something with that. You have to deactivate it at the end of the fumigation. And, it can be done, but it's going to add labor and it's going to add time and it's going to add complexity to the end of the fumigation if you have to do that.
Yeah, you're exactly right, Ben. And the last thing you want to contend with is unreacted green gas at the end of the fumigation. Let me add one more variable to this as well. As we mentioned, the hydrolysis process for most magnesium products, full hydrolysis occurs 24 to 48 hours after initial exposure. And for most aluminum, you're looking at 48 to 72 hours. If you have a blown seal in the beginning of the fumigation, you may actually be able to regain some concentrations without adding any additional gas, because repairing that seal 12 or 24 or 36 hours into the fumigation, it's quite likely that the solid material inside hasn't completed its hydrolysis process. So there's a pretty good chance of the concentration to bump back up again without having to add any additional fumigant.
That's an excellent point. I'm glad you mentioned that, because I didn't think about that, but you're absolutely right. You may not even have to add gas if it's within the first 24, 36 hours.
That's right. And let's say you start a fumigation in the evening. So the overnight hours are the coolest. And you wake up in the morning and you go to visit the fumigation site, you notice a slight loss of a seal, or something very minor, you quickly repair, the concentrations are still pretty low. And lo and behold, when you check that fumigation 8-10 hours later at 2-3 in the afternoon, all of a sudden the reading has skyrocketed without adding any additional fumigant.
Yeah, another key point on why efficacy monitoring is so necessary, because if you're not monitoring, you're not going to know that.
That's exactly right. So
yeah. So you know, you talked about overnights and multi-day, multi-week fumigations, which are pretty common, especially when we're using phosphine. You know, there's a lot of situations. Well, I mean, any fumigant, you know, you're looking, it's pretty commonplace to have people on site or have the facility exposed to concentrations over a 3 to 5 to 7 to 14 day period. And making sure, I mean, we put warning placards up on the buildings or the fumigated structures to make sure people know not to go in. But I think a lot of times, you know, one of the things that keeps me up at night when I fumigate, you know, when I go home is, okay, the building's under fumigation. Is anybody ignoring the placards and walking inside that structure anyway? You know, I'll sit bolt upright in bed if that thought enters my mind during a fumigation. And I think to myself, oh man, I sure hope not. And then you start getting nervous. So I know a lot of times it's a good practice for us to have site security on hand during the overnight hours, specifically when you know nobody's going to be there, just to keep the place secure, keep it safe. Somebody that may be trained in the ability to take monitoring readings overnight, if that's something that you need done. But generally, just to make sure that people are not entering into areas of the fumigated space or entering into areas around the fumigated space where exposure may occur. So in your opinion, when do you think having site security is a good idea?
The easiest answer to that question is when it's required by law.
So right.
Some states, some municipalities require that someone is there 24 hours a day during the fumigation process. So that's no brainer. Even when it's not required by law, I would really, really strongly recommend that someone is there 24 hours a day that can ensure that they can quickly react or summon help in case of an issue, in case of a blown seal, in case of somebody showing up that doesn't belong there, you know, not just overnight, but if during the day, for example, somebody shows up to cut the grass, do you want them to be within several feet of the fumigated structure with a weed whacker? So to ensure that site is truly secure, I would recommend that someone is there all the time during the fumigation process. Or there's a way to secure it, truly secure it. So there's a secure fence perimeter that goes all the way around it with a lock and gate, and the facility can be kept secure that way. You know, those instances, periodic checks would be sufficient. But obviously, if the area or the municipality or the state requires that a live person is there 24 hours a day, then that's a no-brainer. And as far as having someone there, there are a couple different options. You can use a third-party security company. You can use the fumigation company's personnel, or you can also use some personnel of the facility. And that's always a good way of doing it because they're familiar with the facility. They're familiar with who should be and who shouldn't be arriving. And oftentimes during shutdown, that may be a good way to utilize some of the facility personnel to still be able to give them hours, if you will, so they can still work during the fumigation process. Sometimes a combination of the two or the three will be best. So you would have someone there as a third-party official security guard, and you would have also someone there from the fumigation company or from the customer's staff.
All of those are excellent ideas. You know, and another thing that I would mention too is this is another reason why it's so important to have good communication with the facility managers or the people that are responsible for the property that's being fumigated. Because a lot of times they're going to know the common people that would show up, you know, having communication with them. They can then in turn have communication with their employees, their contractors. They can possibly have somebody on site if they want, but it all really starts with having good communication there. And it also starts with having experienced fumigators on hand, because every situation is going to be a little bit different. There may be, especially like if it's the very first time that you're fumigating a facility, you may want to have somebody there 24 hours a day just to make sure, because you don't know what the expectation is.
And Ben, if I can go back to the locked secured premise as well. So one of the things that I will certainly recommend is, just because a facility has a very robust and effective looking fence with barbed wire or whatever else to keep folks out, One of the things I would definitely do is if there is a gate or multiple gates, is I will put my own locks on those gates, because you never know who has keys. And there may be folks who the facility management doesn't even remember that they're notified whether or not that the site is under fumigation. So once again, going back to the example that we used just a few minutes ago, it's very possible that the grass cutting contractor has a key, because sometimes they come in over the weekend while the facility is vacant to cut the grass. So when they show up during the fumigation process and the gate is locked, they can access the facility with no problem, because they have a key to that particular lock. So unique locks, and anything you can do to keep as many folks out of there as possible is critical.
Absolutely. I mean, using secondary locking systems, it's critical. I know it's a very, very common practice in residential fumigations. And I mean, it definitely should be a very common practice in commercial fumigations as well.
Of course. And oftentimes it's required by the label. And yeah. As we all know, the label is the law. So make sure that you're familiar with the label of the products you're using, and you're following all of the requirements of the label to the T.
Yep. So I only have one more question for you. And I always ask a version of this question on every podcast episode, depending on the subject matter that we're talking about. But what advice would you give a new fumigator, somebody who just got their license, or somebody who's, you know, the first week on the job, second week on the job, but that new fumigator, what advice would you give them about exposure times?
So I will go back to the triangle. You have the three variables of time, temperature, and concentration, and you can manipulate two out of the three to a certain degree, but you can't count on manipulating them to the point of always being successful. So treat every fumigation as a unique circumstance. Make sure that you are monitoring, because it is critical. And I can't believe that I'm saving it for last of this entire conversation, Ben, but make sure you have a well-prepared fumigation management plan that addresses the what-ifs.
Oh, yeah.
Part of monitoring data and part of the monitoring requirements, part of on-site security, all of that should be outlined clearly in the fumigation management plan that was prepared with the client, with management, with the local authorities, even whoever is best suited to ensure that most of the what ifs have been addressed. And I say most because it's nearly impossible to plan for every scenario, but the more scenarios that are covered, and sometimes the resolution to one scenario may carry over as a resolution to another scenario. So even though you haven't planned for a specific what if, a very similar plan of action may be able to address that as well. So the FMP is critical, and a good FMP that's prepared to cover as many variables and to ensure that as many unknowns are addressed is critical.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned all that too. You know, there's some sayings in our industry that are pretty commonplace. And you mentioned one earlier that Herb used to say all the time, which is, if you're not monitoring, you're not fumigating. You know, another very common saying that we hear all the time is, if you're not documenting, it didn't happen.
That's right.
So that's where that fumigation management plan comes into play. If you're not documenting everything that you're doing, you're monitoring readings in every step of the fumigation, you have no proof that you've done anything at all. And I hate to say it, but there are times when that stuff gets brought into courts of law. If, God forbid, something from a safety perspective comes into play, if there's a failure on a fumigation, if there's damaged product, a lot of times litigation gets involved. And if you don't have documented proof that you followed all the correct steps, you're going to be in a sling for sure.
That's right. That's right.
All right. Well, that's all I had for you, Bartek. I really appreciate you taking some time out of your day to talk about exposure periods with us.
Ben, thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to discuss this. It's a critical part of the fumigation process that's near and dear to my heart. I've always taken monitoring very seriously, and I wish you all the best with the remainder of your podcast season.
Well, thanks. I appreciate it.
Ben, have a great day. Thank you.
You too. Thanks. I want to thank Bartek for going over some of the basics on how to accomplish the many tasks necessary during the fumigation exposure period. Remember, the fumigation exposure period is still an important time to remain vigilant. On the next episode of Degish America Presents, we'll discuss the aeration procedures you'll need to adhere to in order to finish the fumigation. And remember, if you have any questions at all that you'd like for us to answer, please feel free to email us at podcast@degishamerica.com. You can also find us on our website at degishamerica.com or on all of the main social media outlets. Until next time, I'm Ben Harrell, and I hope you have a safe and terrific day.